What I'd like to do today is to move on to the next chapter on acids and bases. Still want to wrap up the gas chapter and solids and liquids a little bit more, but I'll do that once I pass back your quizzes, which I'll do on Thursday. Hopefully you all know that we have our next exam next week, so that's why I wanted to make sure to get into this next chapter so we get through it, so we have plenty of time to review on Thursday. So acid-base chemistry is one of the most important branches of chemistry. A lot of biological reactions are nothing more than acid-base reactions. And where I'd like to start with is just some definitions of acids and bases. Now, I know some of you might have had a little bit of chemistry in your past classes before, so does anyone have any idea what an acid or a base is? Yes. So there are some properties that acids and bases often have. Not that it's always the best idea to go around filling solutions of acids and bases, but yes, if you take something that's basic, often it'll have sort of a slippery, soapy feel to it. But from a chemical perspective, does anybody know what an acid or a base is? Yes. Okay, so there is this thing called the pH scale that we're going to get into. But it has, the definitions have something to do with the structure of the substances. Yes? That's right. So this is the definition known as the Arrhenius definition of acids and bases. Which I got to back up just for a minute because I'm not sure. Have I ever defined the term dissociate before? No. Okay. So dissociate is a way of just saying to break a bond. So if you say that water dissociates, that means it's going to break apart. And so in using that term, under the Arrhenius definition, an acid is a substance that dissociates to produce H+, which the common way is, was said earlier, to refer to that H+, is to call it just a proton. Why? Because if you look at the normal form of hydrogen, the one that's most common, hydrogen has just a proton in the nucleus and then an electron that's whizzing around it. So if you lose that electron, make H+, the only thing that's left is a proton. So chemists very frequently use the phrase proton to refer to the H+ ion. A base is a substance that dissociates to produce hydroxide, OH minus. Which, if you look at those definitions, that means if we take an acid and a base and we react them together, H plus and OH minus are going to combine to make water. Plus, as we're going to discover in just a moment here, there's going to be something left over that we can classify as a salt. So why is it that we have these definitions of acids and bases? Well, an awful lot of chemistry is water-based, including what goes on in us. Biological chemistry, again, is a lot about acid-base reactions, and of course, we're water-based creatures. So how water behaves is the reason that we have this definition of what acids and bases are. Now, I'd like to step outside the text just for a second to give a little bit deeper explanation to that. And in order to do that, I want to tell a little bit of a side story first that may come up in a future chapter, but I think it's appropriate to tell the story here as well. And here's the story I often tell. Imagine that I were to take some water and pour it out on the desktop up here. And then if we left the room and came back tomorrow, assuming that nobody else had cleaned it up, would the water likely still be here? Probably not, right? We have the common intuition that would probably evaporate away. But that brings up an interesting point, because at regular atmospheric pressure, what's the boiling point of water? 100 degrees Celsius, right? We hopefully are not ever going to get up to 100 degrees Celsius in the room. So why is it that the water is able to evaporate? Yeah. That's a great guess, and yes, there's some of the water molecules that would prefer to be in the gas phase, but technically the boiling point of water is 100 degrees Celsius, so there's a little bit more that's going on there. Anyone else have a guess what might be happening? Yeah. Well, no, but it is doing some breaking apart as well, which is why the bringing up the story in relation to acids and bases. Here's something to think of. Imagine that I could somehow cover the whole side of one of these walls with some kind of ping pong ball or rubber ball, something that's really bouncy. And imagine I could hit a button where I launch all those balls out from the wall at exactly the same time. And maybe they'll all be traveling the same speed for a little while until they start bumping into things. But that means after some time, as they all bump into each other, some of them are going to start moving more quickly, some of them are going to start moving more slowly. And that's exactly what happens inside of any kind of gas or liquid or even solid. The molecules or bonds in a substance do not all have exactly the same energy to them. So there's this graph, which actually comes up in kinetic molecular theory. It actually comes up in talking about gases, but we did not have that in the chapter that we just covered. And this is a graph that's a type of population graph, which, to give you an idea what that means, imagine I was to ask everybody in the room what their age was. And if on the x-axis I put down the ages, and on the y-axis I put down how many of us were each of those ages. That's a style of population graph. So in this case, what if I was talking about the energy per molecule? And I looked at the number of molecules that had that particular energy to it. It turns out that shape of the graph depends on temperature. So if I have something that's at lower temperature, most of the molecules would be moving at a slower speed. They would have less energy to them. As temperature increases, that distribution of energies, that distribution of speeds, starts to spread out. So you get a wider distribution, and at the same time, there are more molecules at higher energy, which would make sense if we're going to higher temperature. So this energy distribution graph comes up a lot of places in chemistry. This could be used to explain why water evaporates at room temperature, even though it's not at its boiling point. Because let's say that I draw some kind of line on here. And that could represent the amount of energy, for example, it takes to evaporate. Well, you can see that even at low temperature, there, if I shade in this area here, we see there's some fraction of molecules that's going to have enough energy to be able to evaporate. And of course, as we increase temperature, that fraction of molecules is going to increase. So this, again, is what happens with water evaporating at below its boiling point. Some of the molecules end up having enough energy to boil. Well, not boil, evaporate. Of course, the reverse ends up being true, too. Once water molecules go into the gas phase, then not all of them end up being able to stay in the gas phase. For example, you must have noticed in the morning, if you take a hot shower, if you take one for too long, eventually there's water that collects on the inside, on the ceiling of the shower, or on the mirrors in the bathroom. And that's because water has been turned into its vapor form, but then some of the molecules start moving more slowly. So then they reach the point where they're going to condense again. And there actually ends up being this balance that can happen where you end up with the rates of it evaporating and condensing both being the same. That's a situation known as equilibrium, which I believe we do cover in a later chapter. So in a big open room like this, though, it turns out that water never reaches that balance point. It never gets to the point where condensation can match that rate that's evaporating. And that's why all the water eventually would disappear. Now, what does that have to do with acids and bases? Well, the same thing applies to water molecules being able to break apart. So if you look at the structure of water, there's a way we could talk about water's dissociation, the fact that bonds can break in water. And I'm going to use an arrow to represent that process, because we're going to use that same style arrow later on to talk about acids and bases reacting. So this arrow, what it represents is that the tail of the arrow shows where electrons are coming from, and the head of the arrow is showing where electrons are going to. We know that oxygen is a more electronegative element than hydrogen, so it makes sense that if this bond ends up breaking somehow, it makes sense that the electrons fall back to oxygen. Well, that means once it happens, that bond breaking, you end up with hydrogen that has nothing left around it. That's why you end up with an H+. And now you've got oxygen that's got extra electrons around it, which we learned about formal charge in our lab exercise. So if we look at the number of electrons around oxygen, it's got 6 lone electrons plus effectively 1 from the bond that it's got. So it's got 1 more than it needs to have its normal number of valence electrons, so that's why it ends up negatively charged. But this process happens automatically in water to some degree. So even water that has nothing else added to it is going to have some small concentration of H plus and OH minus ions. And that's the other reason that we have this Arrhenius definition of acids and bases. It's because of the behavior of water. So even if this is a little bit outside the text, I wanted to describe that to you, and let me put that in text form. At any temperature, there is some fraction of water molecules that are able to dissociate. Due to the amount of energy that they have. This process is known as the ionization of water. Now, auto, you might think automobile, which is good because that term auto means self. So automobile is something that's able to move under its own power. Auto-ionization means that it happens all by itself. Again, nothing else has to be in water for this process to occur. It's because of this auto-ionization that we have this most fundamental definition of acids and bases. So this process is why one of the definitions of acids and bases revolves around H plus and OH minus. But it turns out that that's a somewhat limited definition. And let me try to explain why. So if we have something like acetic acid, actually, let me stop and make a good point about this compound itself. You see, there's several hydrogens in this compound. Not all of them are able to act as acid protons, which it's beyond the level of this course to be able to know which hydrogens are going to react and which ones are not. That's something you only get with a little bit more experience in chemistry. But it turns out that the hydrogens directly connected to the carbon aren't acidic almost at all. It's relatively difficult to remove those hydrogens. The hydrogen that's connected to oxygen is easier to remove. And I can give some explanation for why that is. Because oxygen is very electronegative, you could say that that bond is polarized, meaning that there's a dipole there, and electrons are already partly drawn towards the oxygen. So that makes it easier for the hydrogen to disconnect since you've already got something tugging on that bond. And so there, with enough experience, you can learn enough of these types of stories to understand which hydrogens will react, which ones don't. But your text does mention this fact that not all hydrogens are reactive. So I wanted to make sure to mention that. So in this compound, you do have one hydrogen that can act as an acid. And let's say that we have something like sodium hydroxide that's in solution. Sodium hydroxide is an ionic compound. And in order for it to be able to dissolve in water, it has to break apart. It has to dissociate. So we have just OH ions floating around. The way these two compounds react is that one of the lone pairs on hydroxide will react with that hydrogen to make a new bond. Hydrogen can only have one bond at a time, so what ends up happening as a response is that the oxygen-hydrogen bond in acetic acid breaks. And so you end up making an anion out of acetic acid, which the name for that is acetate. And then we end up making water as well. There's another substance that can do exactly the same thing. And that would be the molecule ammonia. So ammonia, if I wrote its full structure out more, we could see that it would have three nitrogen-hydrogen bonds, and then to complete its octet, it would have a lone pair of electrons. Well, that lone pair of electrons can act just like hydroxide does, where it can attack a hydrogen, cause acetic acid to break apart, and so again, we're going to end up with acetate. But we also end up with ammonium, which you might recognize as one of those polyatomic ions you had to learn. So in this reaction, there's no hydroxide involved, but we still have a reaction that looks just like an acid-base reaction that hydroxide would undergo. So we have a little bit broader definition of what acids and bases are as well that doesn't focus on hydroxide. It focuses just on the hydrogen. And so that is that's actually the definition that's most commonly used. It's something known as the Brunsted-Lowry definition. So under this definition, an acid is a substance that dissociates to make H+. Which, yes, that's exactly the same as the Arrhenius definition, because it's about the H+ this time. In the Arrhenius definition, it's about what water does, which water also can make an H+. So it turns out that, yes, Bronsted-Lowry acids are the same as Arrhenius acids, and Arrhenius acids are the same as Bronsted-Lowry acids. Another way of saying it, though, under the Bronsted-Lowry definition, is that an acid is a proton donor. It's something that gives a proton to solution or to something else. A base, then, is a substance that reacts with H+. Which, another way of saying that, is it is a proton acceptor. So I've already shown the molecule ammonia, and that's very commonly used as the example of a Bronsted-Lowry base. So ammonia is a Bronsted-Lowry base. Because it does react with H+. But it is not an Arrhenius base, since ammonia does not have hydroxide as part of its structure. So now, excuse me. So now we've got our two main definitions of acids and bases. Which, again, I'd like to step just a little bit beyond the text, because I don't seem to see it here. But since you've got most of the story already, let me tell you a little bit more about definitions of acids and bases. Because there are other substances that will react with ammonia that don't have any H+ in them. An example of that is the molecule borane. Borane is not a molecule that came up in our normal Lewis dot structure discussion because borane breaks the normal rules. And that's because boron itself only has three valence electrons, and then each hydrogen can only donate one electron to it. So it forms a structure that doesn't have any charges, but also doesn't have an octet, which it exists, but it's really, really reactive stuff. And so what happens if you combine borane with ammonia? This time I'll write the structure of ammonia out. There's a very rapid reaction where the lone pair of nitrogen will very quickly connect with the boron. And so you form this complex where the two have combined. And if we did look at formal charges, it's also unusual because we end up with a separation of charge. The nitrogen ends up positively charged, the boron ends up negatively charged. But now boron does have an octet. So that's the reason that this kind of reaction can occur. So the thought was this. Well, if ammonia is reacting in the same style as it would with H+, well, maybe we can expand our definition of acids even further. And this is what's known as the Lewis definition. Same like Lewis dot structures. And it's the broadest because now it doesn't focus at all on what the substances are reacting. It focuses on how they're reacting. Which notice that everywhere where I've shown a base reacting, like up here with ammonia, if I scoot a little further up here with hydroxide, the base is something that's providing electrons. And then the acid, like acetic acid here, it ends up accepting those electrons. The same way that boron is accepting the electrons in this example here. So the Lewis definition is all about electrons. So an acid under this definition accepts an electron pair. And a base donates an electron pair. So I mentioned this, like I said, only because we've already got the other two main definitions. And in case you happen to go any further in chemistry or even in a biology class, they might use the phrase Lewis acid. And so I would want you to understand that that means something that could react with a pair of electrons. So we probably won't come back to this definition much, but I wanted to mention it. But let me ask, does anyone have any questions on the previous two definitions or anything else that I've gone over so far this morning? Yes?
Is there like a more accepted version, or like do chemistry students do both of them?
So the two that are used most commonly are Bronsted-Lowry and Lewis. So like even in the normal Chem 1A course, most of the time we're talking about Bronsted-Lowry acids because... you're not always in aqueous solution. Like if you go to organic chemistry where things are carbon-based, you don't necessarily have water around. A lot of reactions still can be described by how protons move around. And I keep referring to biological chemistry where you can have an action inside of a cell where you might have H pluses that are being handed off from molecule to molecule where you might not have water involved. And so that broader definition where you focus on the H plus covers an awful lot of chemistry. So that's why we tend to stick with the Bronsted-Lowry definition. But in a little bit more advanced chemistry, we use this Lewis definition. Because again, referring to organic chemistry, there's some reactions where you have something that might act as a base in the Bronsted-Lowry sense. It might go off and react with an H plus, or it might do the same thing with some carbon-based molecule. So to make the comparison, we would use the phrase in this Lewis acid-base reaction. But that's not nearly as common as the Bronsted-Lowry definition. Bronsted-Lowry definition still lets you talk about aqueous reactions. It just doesn't have to have hydroxide involved. Which, not to go too deep into that, but another issue is that most substances that have hydroxide as part of its structure aren't actually soluble. I mean, the really common chemicals like sodium hydroxide, that you might have even heard that name even before you took chemistry, that happens to be an exception where the sodium makes it really soluble. But if you have things like magnesium hydroxide, calcium hydroxide, other hydroxides, they don't actually dissolve very well in water. So that's also why the hydroxide definition of a base is somewhat limited. So you can use all three definitions, but mostly in real life, we don't tend to use the Arrhenius. Yes?
Can you explain what's different about this diagram that you said was separate from the norm?
This is different because there's no H plus involved. There's no OH minus involved, either one. So in the Arrhenius definition, you have to have both an H plus and an OH minus. In the Bronsted-Lowry definition, it's all about the H plus. Here, it's all about the electrons. And so that's the difference with the Lewis definition. It focuses on what's happening with the electrons. Any other questions? Okay, so I want to jump around the chapter a little bit because someone brought up the concept of pH earlier. So in order to talk about pH, we have to talk about logs, which there's no reason to feel embarrassed about this, but how many of you have not had logs, logarithms in your math classes before? Oh, you all have had them. Okay, because I didn't think there was much of a math requirement for this course, so I wasn't sure. Maybe we could just spend 60 seconds reviewing really quickly, though? Okay. So it all has to do with what's called a base. So we're probably familiar with our normal counting system where we count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and then 10. Once we reach the number 10, we've got another digit that we put into our number. And I'm sure back in kindergarten or early grades, you learned how to put numbers together where you talked about the ones place and the tens place and the hundreds place and all that. Well, that's not the only way we can count. Some of you who might be into computers might know about the binary system. That's where everything is represented just with ones and zeros. So you don't talk about the one and the ten and the hundreds place. You talk about the one, two, four, eight, like that. It's a different style of counting. So that number that determines what the digits are, that's called a base. And it's easier maybe to talk about exponents, where if we take 10 and put an exponent in front of it, that means how many times do we multiply 10 by itself? So of course, if you multiply it by itself only once, you get the number 10 out. If you take 10 and square it, you're going to get the number 100. You take the number 10 to the third, you're going to get 1,000. Well, a log is just the reverse process of that. So there are two different logs you probably have on your calculator. One that's L-O-G and one that's L-N. The L-N uses a different base known as the natural number E, which I forget the number without looking up. It's 2 point something. Way back when I used to have it memorized. But since we got all these calculators now, no need to memorize it anymore. So that LN number does come up a lot in equations. Not in this case. If we're talking about pH on your calculator, it probably would be the log button, and it might even have this little number 10 down below it. And that 10 means the base. It means the counting system that we're using. And so if you say something like this, what is the base 10 log of 1,000? What that means is what power did you have to raise 10 in order to get the number of 1,000? And as we can see up here, that's the number 3. So a log system is where you come up with the exponent. And all these logs are going to deal with powers of 10. Now, mostly, if we're talking about pH, well, let me go ahead and define what pH is. pH is defined as the negative base 10 log of the H plus concentration in solution. So why is it a negative number that we put in there? Well, because usually the H plus concentration is something less than 1. For example, in neutral water at 25 degrees Celsius, I'm jumping around a little bit too much, because we got to define what the term neutral means. Which some of you might have this idea it's connected to pH, and we're going to get to that connection in a second. But from a chemical perspective, does anybody know what the term neutral means? Yes.
Does it have to do with it doesn't want to
accept
electrons?
Not necessarily. It's not talking about how the thing itself would react. That's a good guess, though. Yes, and do you have an idea what that might be? So that was kind of the answer that he gave. And no, in this sense, that's not what the term neutral means. But you're on the right track. It means that you've got a system, a solution, an environment that has the same amount of H plus and OH minus. So neutral is where the concentrations of H plus and OH minus are equal. And that goes back to our Arrhenius definition again, because that's what you have in water. If I could scoot the page down just for a moment here, because earlier I drew this diagram of water breaking apart. And we can see that one water molecule is going to break apart into exactly one H plus and one hydroxide. So if we're doing our definitions of acids and bases on the basis of water, then if we have equal amount of H plus and OH minus, we effectively have water, which we call neutral. If it's got a balance of acid and base, which means it's neither one, that's what neutral is. So more generally, neutral is whenever we have the same concentration of H plus and OH minus. So now I can make the statement, in neutral water, at 25 degrees Celsius, the concentration of H plus, which, oh, I just realized, I haven't explained these brackets before, have I? Okay. A lot of little details I got to remember to cover here. So these brackets, this represents concentration in terms of molarity. Which, remember what molarity is. That's moles of whatever we got, in this case H+, per liter of solution. And for most of the chemistry you're going to see in this class, if we talk about concentration, molarity is actually the way we tend to talk about things. And a lot of the mathematical equations that we might use related to concentration, even in more general chemistry, they tend to use molarity as the unit of concentration. So whenever you see brackets around a substance like this, that means molarity. So in neutral water at 25 degrees Celsius, the concentration or the molarity of H plus equals 1.0 times 10 to the negative 7. So what would the pH of that be? Well, it is the negative base 10 log of effectively 10 to the negative 7. Because 1 times anything is that thing itself. Now, if you're kind of weak on logs, as it's been a while, this is actually one of the easier log problems to solve. Because if you've got the exponent already, and you can see the number in that exponent, well, the log is just equal to that exponent. So you get negative, negative 7, which gives us positive 7 as a number. So this was maybe a long-winded way of explaining why do we have the negative in this pH definition? Because almost always, it's going to give us a positive value. And even for someone that doesn't know much about chemistry, you might end up using the pH scale. I mean, if any of you do any kind of, I mean, maybe with your age you wouldn't, but if any of you are into gardening at all, pH of soil can really affect how things grow. A very simple example is, well, again, given your age, you might not know about these things. But does anyone know what a hydrangea is? So on the screen right now, we've got an example of some different types of hydrangeas. It's a big flower that's got like a big puffball of little flowers that are all tied together. And as you can see, the colors range from a light blue to a more purple type of color. Well, certain types of hydrangeas, you can change what color the flower is just by changing the pH of the soil, which, if I remember correctly, if you go to more acidic soils, you tend to get more of the blue color. If you go to more basic soils, you tend to get the more pink color. So if any of you have ever maintained a pool before, you know, have these little test kits where you come up with a pH of the water, which has to be maintained at a certain point in order that for be the right kind of environment to enjoy a pool. So there's places in normal everyday life where we use pH without necessarily having to know all the chemistry behind it. So that's why I'm taking a little while to describe this pH scale, which your textbook does talk about examples of substances that show up at different places on the pH scale. So normally we put 7 right in the middle because that's neutral. And we have 0 and 14 that are the regular ends of the scale. It is theoretically possible to go past those two values, but that's going to get us off track a little bit. So now this might take a little bit of mental math here, but imagine that we had a higher and higher concentration of H+, which means we're putting something that's acidic into solution. Well, if you had a higher H+, what is that going to do to your pH value? Going to make it go lower. So 10 to the negative 6 is a bigger number than 10 to the negative 7 because a negative exponent makes the number smaller. So 10 to the negative 7 is a smaller number than 10 to the negative 6. So 10 to the negative 5 is even bigger. 10 to the negative 4 is even bigger. If you take the negative log, that means that the less negative the exponent is, the higher the pH actually is. So, right, I said that backwards. The smaller the exponent is, the smaller the pH is going to be. So as you go more and more acidic, you actually go to the zero side of the scale. So acidic is down here at the zero end of the scale. Basic is on the upper end of the scale. And just to give some examples, let me see what your textbook gives as examples here. One second. So pure water is right at 7. And remember, this is a log scale, which means if you go from pH 7 to pH 6, then that's 10 times more acidic. You go from pH 6 to pH 5, that's again 10 times more acidic. So if you go from 7 down to 1, that's a million times more acidic. So if you keep that in mind, then between 1 and 2 here, that's where stomach acid shows up. And you've got protective lining in your stomach to protect the rest of your own self from what's in your stomach. Because, well, not to be too gross about it, but your stomach contents would be able to dissolve or chew up a lot of the rest of your body tissue. That's how acidic that stomach acid is. Because if you think about it, something's got to break down that food that we eat. So it's an awfully, awfully acidic environment. Of course, not too far off from that, and I didn't realize this, soft drinks are down here pretty at the acidic scale too. I guess that's why the dentists say don't have so much soft drink so you don't end up exposing your teeth to too much acid. Biological pH is just a little bit above 7. So around 7.2, 7.4. And there's this entire system in your body that keeps that pH level maintained. Because if you go much outside of that range, even just a few tenths of a pH unit one way or another, that can actually be a lethal situation. So down on the other end here, baking soda. I don't know how many of you cook other than to boil water. But if you use baking soda, that's somewhat basic. Even more basic if you have something like an antacid. So it uses the phrase milk of magnesia. So something that fights stomach acid, pretty far down on the basic end of the scale. Of course, even more basic would be household ammonia, an ammonia-based cleaner, which we know ammonia is one of those Bronsted-Lowry bases. You don't need to memorize any of these values. This is just giving, I'm just repeating some of the examples of acids and basic substances that are given in your text. So, that's the pH scale. So, any questions about the pH scale? Okay, so we've got acids and base definitions, we've got pH. So, the next thing that I want to talk about is the phrase neutralize or neutralization. And this is going to seem like a fussy definition, but that happens in chemistry sometimes. Neutralize means to react equal moles of acids and bases. I'm going to add just a little comment to that, though, to make it even more correct. It's to react equal moles of acids and bases, assuming the acid only dissociate to make one H plus, and bases only react with one H plus. Because after the break, we'll talk about some examples of acids and bases. And there's some very common substances like sulfuric acid, which end up being able to donate two H pluses per molecule. So the better way to say it is that neutralize is where you have a stoichiometric balance between acids and bases. But an easier definition first time through is to say, well, you have equal moles of acids and bases react. And so a standard neutralization equation might look something like this. Hydrochloric acid, HCl. Turns out the hydrogen-chlorine bond is really easy to break in water. In fact, when you put it into water, nearly 100% of it breaks apart automatically. So HCl and sodium hydroxide. They'll react with each other because the H plus and OH minus will combine to make water. And then you have things left over floating around in solution. The sodium is left over from sodium hydroxide. Chloride is left over from hydrochloric acid. So you get sodium chloride, which is salt. But in chemistry, the term salt is broader than just referring to sodium chloride. Effectively, it could be any kind of ionic substance. So I already wrote it earlier, but just to highlight it, a standard neutralization equation, at least with something with hydroxide in it, is that acid and base react to make a salt and water. So to give you a little bit of heads up in terms of timing, I guess I thought it was going to take me longer to get through some of these topics than it has. So if you look at the syllabus, it says that we're still supposed to be covering acids and bases on Thursday, but it looks like that we might actually move on to the next chapter on Thursday. So I don't know yet what that's going to mean for the exam. I need to look over it and decide. It may be that we'll continue on just so we don't waste class time, but it might possibly end up being where I won't put the next chapter on the exam. Now, for those of you who might have come in a little bit late, I'm actually under the weather. I'm functioning on a reduced number of brain cells right now, so I do need to take a little bit more careful look at the text to see what I think would be fair to put in for the exam. But I just wanted to give you a heads up to acknowledge that I realize that I'm starting to move a little bit ahead of schedule. So I'll announce on Thursday what that ends up meaning as far as the exam. So now back to acid-base chemistry. Something I want to talk about now is it is a topic in your text, and it's something that's a little bit more advanced topic related to acids and bases. And that has to do with what are known as strong versus weak acids and bases. Now, strong and weak don't mean how hazardous the substances are. Strong and weak have to do with dissociation. And I'm going to use acetic acid as my example. And I might have used it already up here and didn't realize it. I did. I'll just repeat, I'm operating on reduced number of brain cells today. But I used a reaction arrow here that I haven't defined before. because you see that it has arrows pointing in both directions. And this is what is known as a reversible reaction arrow. And this is a concept that even in the standard chem majors course often doesn't get introduced early enough. We have this sort of idea that chemical reactions start at the beginning, end up at the products, and that's the end of the story. But a large number of reactions aren't quite that simple. They are actually able to undergo reverse processes as well. And I can give you one really good biological example, which is the way that oxygen gets transported through the blood. So hopefully you've learned some point in your health or science classes that the way that cells respire is that when you breathe in, you have these really thin membranes in the lungs, in the alveoli, where oxygen is able to transport over from the open atmosphere into the bloodstream. And then in the blood, you have molecules known as hemoglobin. Hemoglobin actually is what's known as a macromolecule. It's got four different subunits to it, two of which are identical to each other, the other two of which are identical to each other, and all four of which have iron centers in them. Oxygen is able to connect to the iron center in hemoglobin, and then it gets transported into the bloodstream. And then at some point, that oxygen gets released again. Well, that's the whole point of what I'm trying to get at here, that that's a reversible reaction, that oxygen can stick to that iron, but it could get released again. If that reversibility didn't happen, well, there wouldn't be any us. So reversible reactions show up in a lot of places in chemistry, and one of the most important areas is actually in acid-base chemistry. So when you see a reversible arrow like this, maybe the reaction could go quite a bit forward. Maybe it doesn't go forward very much at all. And that actually ends up being the case here for acetic acid. Now, there's a way to quantify all this, to put numbers to it, which your text avoids doing. And I'm going to do the same. But there is a way to come up with a very simple ratio of how much product you end up producing versus how much reactant ends up being left over. And it turns out that in something like acetic acid, this process of dissociating happens less than 1% of the time. So now, if you forced it to react, if you put a base in, you could force acetic acid to react further, but all on its own, it only dissociates a little bit in solution. So that is what is known as a weak acid. A weak acid, again, doesn't have to do with how hazardous it is. In fact, hydrofluoric acid, HF, is a really amazingly hazardous stuff, but it's classified as a weak acid because of how much dissociation goes on. So weak acid is a substance that only undergoes minimal dissociation in solution to produce H+. So let me just write that comment I made. That only around 1% dissociation occurs. So the opposite of that would be something known as a strong acid. So hydrochloric acid is a typical example of that. That's a substance that extensively or completely dissociates in solution. To produce H plus. So in theory, we could write the same kind of expression but in this case, virtually all, I'll say greater than 99.9% dissociation occurs. So given these definitions, I want to give you some very common examples. Maybe not as common in everyday life, but in chemistry terms, very common examples of strong acids, weak acids, strong bases, and weak bases. So some example of strong acids. The three that come to mind most rapidly are hydrochloric acid, nitric acid, and sulfuric acid. Now let me explain about the naming of these things a little bit. So HCl, that name is hydrochloric acid. Its name is derived from the fact that it's only got two elements in it. So it's hydrogen attached just to one other thing. We already know about the polyatomic ion nitrate. So that's NO3 minus. When you stick a hydrogen on it, that 8 ending that we have for the ion turns into ic for the acid. So that's why HNO3, its name is nitric acid. Now, SO4 minus 2, that's another one of our ions we learned about, sulfate. So same thing, the 8 ion in sulfate turns into ic. So H2SO4, it's called sulfuric acid. Now all three are strong, which means they completely dissociate. But that means that sulfuric acid can break apart into two H pluses as well as the sulfate ion. Now, some examples of weak acids. Well, we already got acetic acid. That's an extremely common one. HF, hydrofluoric acid. That's the one that even though it's a weak acid, it's really, really hazardous because what it can do is it can seep through top layer of skin and eventually interact with bones to destroy your bones effectively. The fluoride ion really loves to bind with calcium, which is what your bones are made out of. Hydrofluoric acid is used sometimes in biological labs to clean out glassware because it'll effectively rip the top layer of glass off and make something that's absolutely clean and sterile. It just happens to be really hazardous. So in case any of you ever working with this stuff, you want to be really, really careful with it. Let me see what your text has as examples of weak acids. Oh. Well, no. I'll leave that one out. No, that's given in your text. So HCN, which, let me just double check. It does have the name hydrocyanic acid. So those are the only three that I would want you to know offhand. Now for strong bases, the two that are most common are sodium hydroxide and potassium hydroxide. As far as weak bases, the most common example is ammonia. But there's a whole class of compounds known as amines. So let me tell you just a very quick side story. If you look at acetic acid, when you write its structure out, it's got this pattern where it's got a carbon connected to two oxygens. One of them's double bonded, one of them's single bonded, and the single bonded oxygen has a hydrogen on it. There are many other compounds that have exactly that same structure to it. And I can't think of one that you would be familiar with. I'm just not able to think quickly enough today. But a structure that is somewhat related to aspirin. So this is not aspirin itself, but it's sort of a parent structure. It's something known as benzoic acid. More complicated molecule. But you notice it has the same group of COOH. And there's a wide variety of naturally occurring molecules that have that same pattern in it. So this group is what is known as a carboxylic acid. And it is what is known as a type of functional group. So a functional group is something that comes up more in organic chemistry, which is organic chemistry is the chemistry of carbon-based compounds. And so in carbon-based compounds, whenever you have the same pattern of atoms show up, it usually has the same behavior. So there's this much larger molecule known as oleic acid, which is one of the main components of olive oil. That oleic acid has exactly the same COOH group on it as well. So it behaves very much like acetic acid does. And organic chemistry, is a lot of it deals with reacting different types of functional groups together. So the reason that I mentioned all this is there's a functional group known as an amine. So let me write this structure in a way that you would better recognize what's going on. So if you take ammonia and you replace one of the hydrogens with a carbon group, then you form something known as an amine. So an amine is something that contains an NH2 group on it, connected to carbon. The only place I can think of where you might have heard of amines is if you've ever heard of amino acids, the things that make up proteins. So amino acids all have an amino group, and they all have one of these carboxylic acid groups. And in fact, that's how amino acids link together to form proteins. The amine group reacts with the carboxylic acid group to make a connection between amino acids. So amines are examples of weak bases because structurally they act very much like ammonia. And you do have this exact compound, which happens to be called methylamine. It's one of the examples that's in your text. So I just wanted to take a minute to explain what amines are. So let me just go back and repeat what the definitions of these things are. Strong acids are acids that completely break up in solution. Weak acids are ones that don't break up in solution. As far as the bases, strong bases want to react extensively with H+. Weak bases, they don't want to completely react with H+. So any questions over strong or weak acids and bases? So there is one weak acid that I forgot to mention. And that happens if you take carbon dioxide and react it with water. The reason I'm mentioning this reaction is there is a section in your text that talks about taking oxides, compounds that have oxygen as part of their structure, and reacting them with water. So if you take an oxide made out of something that's not a metal, which carbon is not a metal, if you react something like that with water, you end up producing an acid. So carbon dioxide plus water ends up making carbonic acid, which, let me use the correct arrow here, this ends up being a reversible process. Now, why would you care at all about carbonic acid? Well, if you've ever had a carbonated drink, carbonated means that it has carbonic acid in it. Because carbonic acid will spontaneously, which means all by itself, break back apart into water and carbon dioxide. It's that carbon dioxide that makes the fizz in a carbonated beverage. So, in fact, these days they sell devices where you could just take normal tap water, take a canister of compressed carbon dioxide, have it squirt through the bottle, it'll charge up the water, force it to react with carbon dioxide, and you end up with carbonated water. So you can produce this type of thing at home now. But that's what carbonic acid is. It's found in soft drinks. So I just realized I left out one of the most common everyday examples of a weak acid. So I've jumped around the chapter a bit, so let me just see which bits that I have missed out on. We talked about the types of acids and bases. We talked about strong acids and bases. Talked about the pH scale. It's a very short section in your chapter that's actually really important stuff. So let me talk about indicators. So an indicator is a substance that changes color depending on pH. And during the break, I was looking over the text, and I didn't realize that the hydrangeas I was referring to earlier are actually mentioned right up here at the very front of the chapter. And it even has another note that says there's other naturally occurring things like blackberries, raspberries, radish peels, turmeric, that also can change color depending on pH. So where do we use indicators in chemistry? Well, suppose that you're doing an acid-base reaction and you wanted to know when you were finished with the reaction. There's one very common indicator that if you've ever heard of any indicator in chemistry, this is the one you might have heard of. It's called phenolphthalein. And that's an indicator that turns clear in acidic solutions and a bright pink color in basic solutions. And so imagine that you had an acid that you wanted to react with a base. So it does depend on which acids and bases you're reacting together as far as which indicator you're supposed to use. This is a little more advanced concept. But if you had something that was a really strong acid, something that easily dissociates, and you try to react it with a weak base, well, once you've reacted equal numbers of moles, it turns out the solution won't end up neutral afterwards. Because a strong acid puts more H plus in solution, a weak base doesn't generate as much hydroxide, and so you end up with an imbalance of H plus and hydroxide. But if you take a strong acid and a strong base and you want to react them together, you can put a few drops of phenolphthalein in the acid. Because as you add the base to it, once you reach that point where you've had the reacted exactly equal number of moles, then the indicator will change color. And that's exactly what indicators are used for. They change colors to let you know that you've reached the end of a reaction. So it even shows a picture of phenolphthalein reacting in your text, but it barely even discusses what that term is, an indicator. So that's something that I felt you should know about. The last section of your text gets into the idea of acid-base conjugates. And so let me just talk briefly about that. So I mentioned carbonic acid earlier. Carbonic acid can break up into the hydrogen carbonate ion. And that can break up even further into the carbonate ion. So the relationship is this. If you have an acid that can break apart and produce H+, then once it breaks apart, that other thing that's left over can act like a base. So these are what are known as an acid-base conjugate pair. That means bicarbonate and carbonate also forms an acid-base conjugate pair. So to give a little more of a definition, an acid-base conjugate pair are two substances that differ in formula only by a proton, an H+. Now, why does it bother telling you about conjugate pairs? Because there's something known as a buffer solution. And this comes up in biology quite a bit. So that is a solution that contains an acid-base conjugate pair. Why does that matter? Because it can resist changes in pH due to the addition of small quantities of an acid or a base. So if we look at the carbonate bicarbonate example, it If you have bicarbonate around, it's got a hydrogen that can react with a base. If you have carbonate around, it is a base that would be able to react with an acid. If carbonate, CO3-2, reacts with an acid, it just makes more bicarbonate. And if bicarbonate reacts with a base, it just makes more carbonate. So effectively, you've got the two things together in solution that can counteract the effect of adding an acid or a base into that mixture. Now, why would that matter? Well, for certain chemical reactions, they might only be successful if you have a particular pH value in solution. And so you might create a buffer system that is at a specific pH to keep the reaction at that pH level while the chemical reaction's going on. This is exactly what's happening in your bloodstream to maintain body pH. So, and in fact, it is a carbonate bicarbonate system that keeps your blood pH right at about 7.2, 7.4. And if your body pH, if somehow you eat something that's really acidic, if that somehow bleeds over into your bloodstream, well, this buffer system is able to protect you to keep your blood pH from varying very much. So I'm sure that's the reason why your text mentions at all what buffer solutions are, because biologically they're extremely important systems. So, unexpectedly, I guess I've reached the end of the chapter here, which there's some little details that maybe I'll come back and talk about on Thursday once you've all had the chance to read the chapter. Since we've got the time left, even though that I don't have them to pass back today, I'd like to go ahead and discuss the answers to the most recent quiz so that you have that information to be able to study from. So let me pull up the questions that were on the quiz. And we might run out of time, but that's okay. We've got Thursday to continue with this as well. And on Thursday, of course, I'll go over a list of the topics that are going to be on test number 2. So on the quiz, first question was to write Lewis dot structures where you had to show the bonds and electrons, but as promised, you did not have to be able to write out the charges, the formal charges. I'm going to go ahead and put in the formal charges just because I like being complete about it, but you were not required to do it on the quiz. So first one was nitrate. So nitrogen has 5 valence electrons, each oxygen has 6, and then we throw in an extra electron because of the negative charge. So that's 24 valence electrons. I'm sure we had done this example in class, but even if we hadn't, I did give you which was the central atom. I underlined it for each of the problems. So nitrogen is the central atom. The oxygens are around it. And the 3 bonds use up 6 of the electrons. So there's 18 left over that exactly would occupy the oxygens. So even without worrying about formal charge, we can tell that nitrogen doesn't have an octet. And so what we would do is we'd take a pair of electrons to move that in to make a double bond. And so the best structure for nitrate is where one of the oxygens is double bonded and the other 2 are single bonded. Now, I'll say it one more time. You did not have to show formal charge, but if we wanted to put them in, nitrogen ends up with a positive charge because it's only got 4 electrons effectively around it because it's got the 4 bonds. And each of the single bonded oxygens effectively has an extra electron around it because it's got 6 lone electrons, but it's also got a bond. So that's 7 electrons effectively compared to the 6 that oxygen would normally have. So that is a complete structure for nitrate. Now, as I'm going over these answers, if anyone have any questions, don't be afraid to stop me because we do have time to discuss. So second structure was one that had also, I know this one came up in lecture, that's HCN, hydrogen cyanide or hydrocyanic acid. Carbon's got 4 valence electrons, nitrogen's got 5, and hydrogen's got 1. So add that all up, and that's 10 electrons total. The carbon's the center atom, so hydrogen and nitrogen are attached to it. And then nitrogen, that's right of carbon on the periodic table, so it's more electronegative, so it would get whatever extra electrons are left over. Because the two bonds only use up 4 electrons, we've got 6 more left. So this again is a case where we don't have octets, at least around the carbon. In order to get that, we need to take 2 pairs of electrons from the nitrogen and share them. And so that ends up making a triple bond between carbon and nitrogen, which this structure has no formal charges. Then the last one, I think, came up in our lab exercise, and that's the molecule formaldehyde. So carbon has 4 electrons, oxygen 6, 2 from the hydrogen, so that adds up to 12 electrons total. Carbon was the central atom, and so writing in the 3 bonds, we still have 6 electrons left over, which would go around oxygen. And just like in nitrate, in order to make an octet, we need to move 1 pair of electrons into a double bond. And this again happens to be a molecule that doesn't have any formal charges on it. Okay, moving on to the next question. This was a balancing reaction question. You were told that when pentane, which I gave you the formula C5H12, undergoes complete combustion with oxygen, O2, you end up making carbon dioxide and water. Now, I didn't tell you which phases these were in. I know that when we went over chemical equations, I mentioned about putting in G for gas, L for liquid. But I didn't tell you which ones were which in this problem, so you did not have to put those in. But what you did have to do is balance the equation, which means put the numbers in front of each of these to make the equation balanced out. And then this is exactly an example that we had done in class, because I think when I talked about balancing reactions, I used a combustion reaction as my example. So if we look, we could see that carbon only shows up 1 place on the left, 1 place on the right, and so the first thing we could do is to put a 5 in front of the carbon dioxide, because that would give us 5 carbons on both sides of the equation. Now, hydrogen only shows up on 1 place on each side as well. So we have 12 hydrogens on the left, so to get 12 hydrogens on the right, we'll put a 6 in front of the water, because each water has 2, and so if we put the 6 in front of it, that makes 12. Remember, we can't change the numbers that are on the right side of an element because numbers inside the formula are for the formula of the substance itself. And if we change those numbers, we'd be changing the substance. So we can only put the numbers in front. So we've got carbon balanced out, we've got hydrogen balanced out, the only thing left is oxygen. So if we look on the right-hand side, we've got 10 oxygens from carbon dioxide. We've got 6 oxygens from water, so that's 16 total. And so to balance it out, we can put an 8 in front of the O2, because that would give us 16 on the left. Okay, next question was a stoichiometry question. You were given this equation where 4 ammonia react with 5 oxygen in order to make 4 nitrogen monoxide, NO, along with 6 water. And you're asked to calculate how many grams of oxygen. So our goal is to figure out how much oxygen we've got, or how much we'll need, to completely react with 20 grams of ammonia. So this is exactly the style of problem we had done in class, where we have 3 conversion factors we're going to need to use. Because if we're given grams, we don't know how many ammonias that is. So first we have to convert into moles. Then we go from moles of one reactant, the ammonia, to the moles of oxygen, which is what the problem is asking about. And then the problem is asking how many grams of oxygen there are, not how many moles. So to set it up, it would look like this. We have the 20 grams of ammonia, NH3. To convert into moles, we say that in one mole of ammonia, there is 17.04 grams of ammonia. And the way I got that is that each hydrogen is 1.01 and the nitrogen is 14.01. Those are rounded numbers that you can get from the periodic table. Grams goes on the bottom because that needs to cancel out with the grams that go before it. That's why the moles end up going on top. And it's always one that goes with the moles, and then whatever number you have goes with grams. So that's the first factor. The second one is we need to go from ammonia to oxygen. So the chemical equation tells us that for every 4 moles of ammonia, we're going to use up 5 moles of oxygen. So ammonia goes on the bottom to cancel out. We want oxygen, that's why it goes up on top. But then there's one more factor, because we don't want moles, we want grams. So in every mole of O2, there are 32 grams of O2. So if we multiply all that out, 20 grams times 5 times 32 divided by 17.04 divided by 4, I get, rounded off, 46.95 grams of O2. The next problem is something that came straight out of the notes. That was asking to define the term solution, solute, and solvent. So solution, that's a homogeneous mixture. The solvent is the major component of a solution. And yes, you could use the word solution there. And then solute is the minor component of a solution. Next problem was a concentration problem. Actually, both of the next problems were. So problem 5, you were told that you have 3.5 grams of salt. For every 97 grams of water. And you're asked to calculate the concentration of seawater, the salt, in terms of mass percent and ppm. So remember that mass percent is the mass of your solute, so that's going to be the salt, divided by the total mass, which, yes, it ends up being a little more than 100, but that doesn't matter. That's okay. That's why we're taking the ratio. So it's 100.5 grams total, and then you multiply that by 100%. So it's going to come awfully close to 3.5. It actually ends up being, we could say, 3.48%. Now, ppm is almost exactly the same calculation. It's just instead of multiplying by 100, we multiply by 1,000,000. So we get, rounded a bit, 34,800 ppm.